Seattle and back tonight. We'll be departing at 5, but we don't want to end up in a big rush. We originally booked to 5:30. We may not go that long, but we're not going to cut it off sharp at 5. We think there's more that you might want to say. We invited you in the beginning to say something about how you would urge us to think about recommendations we might develop. We really would like to get the benefit of that. We do have a couple of final wrap-up questions that people have been thinking about. So let me ask Gail to start.
So this is just a follow-up to some of the earlier points made about the PI having primary responsibility, or the primacy of the PI's responsibility in all of this. You know, we are responsible for the subgroup of the IOM Committee on Responsible Parties, and as Tom mentioned, we also identified the PI as having primacy with respect to responsibility. It's not completely clear to me in this particular case who you mean is the PI, because there are three other names. There are clinical PIs of the three protocols that we've been talking about, and that those names are not Nevin's name. So who do you mean as having ultimate responsibility for a trial? Is it the PI of the trial? Is it the head of the lab?
We're now into the era where we have multiple primary endpoints in clinical trials, which some would say is, can't have that.
Well, and also just in general, what is Nevin's role in all of this? Because we've heard a lot about a lot of other people and not a lot about him.
To the point about multiple primary endpoints, I think there is a distribution of primary responsibility now in team science that cannot be avoided. So in this case, we have the Nevin's lab with a primary idea, clearly the driver, the person who is fervent and adamant about the science. You saw Dr. Nevin's in action. You can draw your own conclusions about, what you think about it. So there is a key element of responsibility there. But he's a PhD with no experience in clinical investigation prior to this. So when it comes to the human studies being done, there is a clinical PI. I think in site-based research, that is small clinical trials, we have to be cognizant of the fact that clinicians with no formal training in clinical trials and no vast experience in the nuances of the difficulties that one can get into, that we need teams. And in fact, one of the big changes that we've made starting next year is formal team-based training as part of our clinical research training, just like we do in the clinical arena now, for the concept that if one person's not there, there's someone else that can step in and understand the role and the experiences. So I don't think when it comes to the clinical investigation that we can say that Dr. Nevin's is the accountable person. In fact, I would argue that it was the responsibility of the clinical investigators to rebuff Dr. Nevin's if he stepped over the line. And I think in retrospect, we've all agreed that that probably should have happened more, and that those with conflict should have gotten a bit more removed from the primary conduct of the trial. I guess the last thing I'll say two last things. In multi-site research, it's, there's an organized system that's a lot more clear. And I think you all have made the point several times in different ways that you can have one site PI that screws up in a multi-center clinical trial if it's large enough, and it doesn't really matter other than you need to correct it so the behavior doesn't recur. But in a small clinical trial, in one site or just a couple of sites, it's going to be common to have busy clinicians that are very involved and who may have a driving idea and a desire to help patients of a particular type by advancing knowledge. You've got to have a team behind that person that has accountability, and there needs to be a leader of that team who's identified, and that's what we've tried to put into place with the site-based research system. And I would also add, you've got to have a system like in the operating room where the study coordinator, this collaborating statistician, even the finance person, if you see something that's not right, can raise a hand and everything stops long enough to figure out what's going on.
Can you make clear there are three trials and the three PIs were, are they all junior people?
Ready and no.
They're not junior. I would say none of them have extensive independent credentials in clinical trials leadership, but they've all done a lot of clinical trials and they're all passionate. If they were here, you just happen to hit a time when it's vacation time. If they were here, you would hear tremendous passion from them about the care of their patients and the importance of doing research as part of your job as an academic clinician. And I think they are the PIs of record. But they were backed by a team which had certain flaws that we've identified.
So who in the case of the statement of task trials, who should have been? Who was that person that was the leader that would be standing behind that person?
Who said should be held accountable.
Right. Or that person wasn't there.
I think the PIs have the primary accountability, even if they're not terribly experienced. But I think they're, in fact, you had the cancer group, you had the IGSP group, and it wasn't clear, and so there was not an individual that was really holding it all together.
So the model you're talking about, that person wasn't there in these trials. And that's part of the problem.
I mean, if someone wants to give a different view, you can imagine the discussions we've had about this particular issue.
Michael, you want to comment?
I can give a little bit of a different view. So I think that for each of the three SOT trials, there was a principal investigator who did have ultimate responsibility with the IRB and has ultimate responsibility for the conduct of that trial. And those people were Jennifer Garst, who was relatively junior, and that trial then transferred through Anil Patti to Gordana Flahovic, who was very junior, but Neil Reddy, who is the adjuvant lung study PI, is not junior. He's led national studies in CLGB, and Kelly Markham for the breast study is also a very seasoned clinical trialist, I think. So I think there was responsibility for the conduct of the trial from that perspective. What there wasn't was, I think, is this team-based interaction with the Nevins group in terms of the data provenance issues. There was close interaction with the Nevins team and the clinical trial group. I've described that already. I think that's essential for doing team science, for doing translational medicine. And how do you identify the predictor aspects in terms of who is responsible for that? Because from the clinician's point of view, they can't be expert at everything. And that's where they have to depend on the basic scientist, the biostatistician, to be able to verify that their contributions to the work is valid and it's right. So I think, ultimately, the clinical trial was PI. And I think when you look at the audit trails that were done, that was done within very reasonable expectations in terms of the quality of the clinical research. What's wrong was the predictors.
And I want to stress again in the comments that I made, these protocols all went through multiple levels of peer review and external peer review, DMC plus review by very esteemed and competent people, despite the one issue that you mentioned about one member of the committee. And the post hoc audits show that fundamentally the data was collected per protocol quite well.
Each had a separate funded grant, right?
Yes. And so it's really it shows how complicated and this whole thing really is, that the issues that are of concern about the clinical trials are really sort of in the middle of process where it does take a team, and no one person can be an expert in all those areas.
Now, Bill, were you the statistician for these three trials, or was there a clinical trial statistician also?
It was there was also a clinical trial statistician, but I was added to them in development, and at some point I think I became sole name on some of the trials. So there was some evolution of the statistical personnel on these trials.
And Jeff, did you have any role in these at all?
No, certainly by design. I was never an investigator or co-investigator on any of the trials. You know, the milieu or the of these trials was, as previously described, as a team approach, and particularly for myself as the leader of the CGSU, I really needed to hear what was happening as these trials moved on to understand the issues that were being raised, the challenges that the team was facing, so that we could adequately address them and provide resources or solutions to them. So it had to be in the environment in which the trials were being discussed at the project team level. But I was never formally a part of the trial itself.
So you had some distance from the day-to-day stuff. And were you independently aware of this Baggerly criticism set and of the process that led to the decision to suspend the first trial, a set of trials?
And I mentioned this earlier. The first indication was from the letter to Nature Medicine back in 2007. And then, you know, after at least I felt satisfied with the response that I had at that point, the next time I was aware of the issues was from the cancer letter in October of 2009.
I don't think we intend to leave you with the view that Jeff was removed from the day-to-day. He was not involved in any patient care decisions. But as we've already said, the study coordinators ended up reporting, some of the study coordinators ended up reporting to Jeff, who were handling the data. And so the team meetings, Jeff was a part of all of those. And, you know, we said we probably should have had a degree of separation on that. But not involved at all with
maybe deeper engagement, and you'd have picked it all up. I think maybe it was this separation has its risks because you had this, you know, super smart,
I think,
experienced
the
guy
issue,
who wasn't so much involved. Yeah,
you know, this is a balancing act of various types. You know, even as we said before, we want to have the scientists who are involved with the developing the technology in the room at some points in time, and similarly, while it's not as sophisticated science, the process issues of really carrying out a genomic-based predictor trial, I felt like I really wanted to understand what the people on the front lines were facing when they were dealing with the radiologists, the surgeons, the pathologists, and all the different components of a health system that have to come to bear to make a trial like this work. And that was the primary motivation for having the CRCs in our group, because they were the ones that were essentially responsible for managing that component of the trial.
Gail, you have any follow-up?
I just have a follow-up question about this notion of team science. I am a huge advocate of team science, and in many ways, as an ethicist and a social scientist, I have been part of an interdisciplinary team my entire career. So to me, it's not new. And I'm hearing what seems like a new sense of the term. So is team science unique in any respect in this context? What's new about it? Because I don't think team science is new.
So I don't think it's new, and I didn't mean to imply that.
I'm not saying you did, but we have been talking about team science.
But I think the complexity of clinical research is ever growing as the science behind the predictors and everything else, the therapeutics, expands, and so the number of team members that you need expands in every regard.
There's also, I think, another element that introduces risk is you have teams of people who don't actually speak the same language necessarily, and ensuring communication among team members in a smooth way becomes an issue. Also, cultural gulfs between team members. I mean, we've talked about data management standards between a basic science laboratory and people who are experienced in clinical trials, and you know, getting both ends of that spectrum to really understand the same standards, et cetera, I think presents new challenges that we haven't dealt with when we were talking about more homogeneous teams.
I wonder if it isn't more about technology, though, because I don't think that the concept of cultural differences are unique. I mean, you get my back. You get a geneticist and a neonatologist in the same room. They have nothing in common in in the way they view the world. So I don't think the issue of cultural differences is new either. There's something, I'm wondering if it isn't about...
But I
would say the technology is new. And so when you're having to bridge language barriers, as a statistician, we're all oftentimes the ones having to bridge with the clinical investigators, you're also walking a landscape in which neither of you really know how to frame, you know, the data structure, the environment you're in. And I think that could be a two levels of the complexity that combine to make it a very difficult environment.
Right. I think there's a lot of people used to dealing with data points one by one that are now being confronted with large data sets. And, the necessity of understanding that the quality controls need to be as rigorous. It's not like doing it 30,000 times makes it better than doing it 3 times if you're not applying certain standards. And again, I think that's an understanding of people delving into areas they haven't worked in before.
And there's a lot of misconceptions in the science that, 30,000 data points gives you 30,000.
Tom, thank you very much.
Hi.
Thank you. 30,000 times more information. So, I think we're having to fight against a lot of misunderstandings at the base level of what this data provides us.
David, another comment? David?
No, I was just going to comment. I mean, the data don't fit in the blue book anymore. The data don't fit in the blue book anymore. And so you can't graph it. You can't wrap your arms around it. So the technology is new, both in the informatics perspective as well as the data generation. So that is new, and we all struggle with that.
It was interesting. I think one point to this is that has come out in this discussion is the, value of gene identities, for instance, when you're looking at large-scale gene signatures and using the individual gene identities to say if it actually made any biological sense. And I think that was part of the issue in thinking about it was the argument that, well, it's just the signatures. It doesn't really matter what the gene identities are. But if you're going to use the identities as arguments that it makes sense, then you do have to start, delving into the individual gene level.
And it's not just the biological arguments. You use that to ground the quality control framework for your research.
Exactly.
Well, in fact, I was at a symposium about proteomics and aptamers and stuff recently, and it's a very interesting data set under development in which they have so many measurements that they can analyze not just for the biological parameters and clinical parameters of interest, but for pre-analytical variation, like lab source of the samples, or a nomogram of time sitting at certain temperature, and stuff that if you could normalize and adjust for, maybe would be useful, but in any case might help you pick out the bad samples in a multi-center study. There's more information than we currently mine if you open up to the kinds of questions that it might be useful to answer. Okay, take a deep breath. Let's go back to the one item we left this morning. And that was, do you have some general comments for us about the kinds of recommendations you suggest this committee consider and include in our report? Across the whole range of what we've discussed or things we haven't gotten to. That's a very big subject we have. You understand our charge. It's about assessing the field, status of omics-based test development, thinking about the technical and biological variation that makes it complicated, drawing lessons from the various case studies we've been able to identify, and please do send me these additional points, and of course how we think the culture, the community, could benefit from lessons learned by all of us. You guys want to start at that end of the table? John and Ross?
New is a challenge for IRBs. New technology is particularly challenging for IRBs. New technology in the presence of the regulatory body not having its own approaches well developed compounds the whole process. And so it's not unexpected that this whole research review activity was murky. And we've got to do something to minimize that likelihood.
I'm trying to frame the way there are two basic things that I think I've heard that would be particularly utile. One is defining the pathway for the establishment of the genomic tests so that people don't recreate or omics tests, don't recreate systems. I mean, I think this looks like the sort of thing that there ought to be algorithmic methods to design the studies. I mean, there ought to be certain strategies that people should attend to, and it would be very useful to have some guidance to that attention. The other thing that from my perspective, and it's because we've been talking about it a lot in the COI community, it's continuing to define the balance between what is the role of the scientist in the continued evolution of new research relative and for the benefit of the public, because having the scientists involved both acts as a catalyst to make things happen. They have insights because they have knowledge, and yet they have conflicts that cause. And so where are those lines that you begin to affect the safety of research subjects, or how can we manage that most effectively while at the same time we continue to realize that we need the energy of the advocate in the continued progress of the science, and that's particularly true if we want to change things. So having some guidance in that regard would be useful.
That last point is quite fascinating. In the world of mechanical physical devices, it is routine to have progressive incremental improvements. Whereas in drugs, until the drug makes the market, a tremendous effort to get it to be approved, but you're pretty much locked in. It's a whole big deal to come up with next generation, even a modest improvement in the drug. And we observe from one of the case studies we're doing is MammaPrint. And there, this is based on work done a decade ago or more, published in 2002, been extensively developed, FDA approved, clinically utilized, but nobody would claim that the 70 transcripts are ideal for this purpose. But they are locked in by an approval process and a marketing process and clinical experience. So it behooves us to think some about this business, about, as you said, staying with the work, trying to make a product better, progressively better, that's what it takes, and how that should be done. I think this is a broad innovation question.
Yeah. I just follow up on that. So I've actually asked some of the developers about product improvement, and there's an extreme reticence, even though they have the data, to move that initiative forward because of needing to go back to the FDA and go through an entirely new process. So I think it's a really interesting and important strategy for this industry, if you will, because they continually acquire new data and could be improving the diagnostics that they originally went out with. But there is a series of regulatory barriers, apparently, and cost issues and resource issues that are really seem to be standing in the way of that. And I think it's just something that needs to be more forcefully addressed.
I think that's absolutely right, although we have the counter case, which is called Oncotype DX, which is not FDA reviewed or approved, just marketed through the same community for more or less same patients, highly successful product,
and it hasn't been put through iterations either. So there's no regulatory hurdle that's affecting that directly, at least in its previous development. Nowadays, maybe it would be expected.
Yeah, and the conversations I've had have been with companies that have gone through the regulatory approval process, so you're absolutely right.
Michael?
So I think the one point that I would make is the design of clinical trials that use omics should be clarified. I think it has pretty much, but I think that needs to be locked down for the clinical research community, at least in the oncology field.
Be a little more specific?
I think one of the areas that the Cancer Protocol Review Committee struggled with was what was the appropriate design, what is the level of validation of the predictor that was necessary to justify a clinical study, and what was the development path for that predictor. I think these are a lot of the issues that have been discussed quite a bit, and I think that there is some clarity now, but I think that this August group could probably clarify that further. Is that clear?
It's actually a sensitive point for us, because at least a few members of our group who've been deeply involved in previous groups, from the clinical pathology point of view, or from ASCO, or from industry, or from previous IOM workshop report, have taken the position that it's all written down, just tell people to go and read it. Others of us say, well, my goodness, obviously people aren't, or not sufficiently. It would be a service, it's either as an appendix or a shortened version in the body of our report. It would be a big service to people. I take it you would agree with the second.
Yes.
Does everybody agree with that?
You think?
I mean, several things so far around the table are about clarification, definition, making pathways that people could actually utilize with greater confidence. This is not about locking things down and blocking innovation. It's about facilitating innovation, I would think. Okay. Your official turn.
Thanks. So having been in industry, I think I learned about the quality of the process to produce a quality product, and having that be very clear what that process is. And I think here we clearly thought we had processes in place that were not as robust as they needed to be. And we've talked a lot today about and thought about it for many months, about things that have been emerged out of the TMQF document that I need not repeat. But having that, particularly for a first-in-man genomic study, we have to set the bar incredibly high to determine the reproducibility of the data, the validity of the data, the integrity of the data management systems, the oversight processes and things that we've talked about. So I think just making that for this small subset of studies today, but which may become a larger, clearly will become a larger number of studies in the future, having that process explicitly defined is going to be key. I think the one area that I heard that we've debated amongst ourselves, and I'm not sure whether you can adequately provide insight, but I wish you would, is this notion of what constitutes validation. Do we need to reproduce in one independent data set, in 10 independent data sets? What are the numbers? What are the kinds of validation studies that is the threshold that we can use to say this is really ready for human experimentation? I think that's a subject of a lot of debate, and I think the literature is replete with unvalidated or with biomarkers, in particular genomic biomarkers, that have not yet been sufficiently validated. And what's that path to get them to the point where we know or we don't know?
This is a critical point. We're mostly here talking about biomarker-directed therapeutic choices, this really matters to clinical decision making. A much bigger part of biomarker work today has been on earlier diagnosis. And in many cases, earlier diagnosis just means you carry your diagnosis for more years and you pick cases up, you know, especially for conditions like prostate, most prostate cancers, and in situ breast cancer and so forth. EDRN program of NCI has had hundreds, thousands of papers on possible biomarker candidates. Hardly anything validated. They have a very extensive formal process, basically not working too well. That's to say, they have labs in waiting, designated to be independent validation labs. But what is usually lacking, in my opinion, is something crucial before validation, which is confirmation. Confirmation in the same laboratory that made the discovery. Too many things are reported without replication by the same group with similar specimens, same laboratory methods. And if you can't do that, expecting it to be validated, replicated, or confirmed in an independent lab is more or less hopeless. But the rush has dominated this process. And in general, this came up earlier today about rushing a process that needs to be done right. So I take that key challenge.
I don't have too much in terms of prescriptive suggestions to the committee. I would say, you know, in addition to the question that was raised about validation, the amount of evidence required, I think clear statements, particularly as you just said, in terms of the rush of under strict guidelines of what is needed validation, you know, how does that impact the process and what are the real scale timelines and what are the real data available to all investigators in that process. I think there needs to be an honest dialogue about how that impacts the process. You know, in terms of, you know, from my own perspective, you know, the only thing that the key element to me is in terms of a different topic is transparency. I don't know how you legislate transparency, but, you know, what are the opportunities to make this process as open to the public and break down that, you know, whatever barriers there are from a traditional basic science framework to allow this to be more openly discussed and scrutinized in a, you know, in an open manner.
Okay. Remind me, please. There are some conventions. One is called REMARC. Mm-hmm. Another is called CONSORT.
There's the CONSORT diagram. There's Miami compliance for...
Right, for microwaves. And there's something MIAPI for proteomics. Mm-hmm. We've had considerable discussion and proposed endorsement of some of these methods. We haven't actually seen independent assessments of their use and their reliability. But in terms of transparency and of compliance with detailed reporting, they seem to have face validity. Do you have experience with these?
I am familiar with them from the research. I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm speaking from a position of naivete, I feel like, from my junior position, but, you know, I don't know how you incentivize to, you know, there's enforcing compliance, but how do you incentivize a greater culture of transparency, I guess, is kind of what I was...
Well, let's back off of that a second and just tell me if you have experience with REMARC and if you agree that it's not onerous and useful and...
I'm not as familiar with the exact...
We should recuse Dr. McShane while we get this answer.
Actually, I must say I'm not familiar with the exact guidelines that REMARC requires.
Okay. Are there any that you are familiar with besides Miami?
I know from a CONSORT diagram, you know, from a CONSORT framework... In a clinical report, you know, what would be required. And so I endorse these as ways of appropriately reporting a discovery process or a validation process.
We've been told that the journal Biostatistics requires authors to use REMARC, has an assistant editor that actually checks compliance, and that this might be a model for other journals, at least specialty journals. you have any experience submitting to biostatistics?
I'm afraid I have not submitted to biostatistics.
Okay. Dave, do you have any comment on that?
No, I think this is something for us really to deliberate on, but the whole effort to try to get transparency to improve the quality of reporting has been very difficult. It's been done some for Consort, but that's the granddaddy because it was started about 15 years ago. I think we heard that Miles Axton, who's the editor of Nature Genetics, or Nature Reviews, it's Nature Genetics, published a study where they did a before and after they started to enforce reporting criteria, and he tried to get independent groups to reproduce, you may know these data, or at least you may know these data, but try to get independent groups to reproduce the studies after the reporting guidelines had gone, and then they didn't do very well. I think the bottom line is that reporting is only one thing that might be successful. It's hard to implement. It's had spotty success. I'm wondering whether, and the committee's considered this, and whether any of you have some thoughts on this, something like, and I'm not advocating this, this is just an idea, periodic audits of some sort, or, you know, the possibility of having an effective audit or adjudication, if that, I don't know if threat's the right word, but if people knew that their stuff was going to be looked at in detail, could that put a healthy fear of God, not necessarily that you're going to do it in a punitive way or do it a lot of times, but just so people know, if this really gets challenged, somebody's going to be able to come look at the data. Rob, this happens all the time in clinical trials, and you've got the data so you can do it, but in other areas of research it isn't done. If reporting doesn't provide incentives, is that something, and you're nodding your head, so maybe you've thought about it, but can you just tell us what your thinking has been on this?
Yeah, so we've discussed this quite a bit, particularly in the context of the translational labs, where there's not routine auditing. And the policy that we're trying to propagate is you need to have data systems that are auditable, not
right.
that we're going to audit. Not that
yeah.
we're going to audit large
yeah.
scale, but you need to have something that would survive an audit
yeah.
should we choose to do so. And that's the standard. I think we're going to try to propagate at that level.
Does that sound doable, and is it met with interest, or what does it look like when you run it up the flagpole?
Well, you know, this is an interesting thing, and when we come to my turn, I'll amplify this a little more, which is I think the weight of the IOM report in selectively making recommendations on some of these things, I think you have to think about, which is, you know, these are large expenses to institutions, and institutions are going to be making certain choices. And, you know, in terms of thinking what elements are most important, I think you're going to have to highlight certain things that you really think institutions need to do, and that's going to help guide institutions to do those sorts of things. In other words, the same thing comes with the recommendation of things like a consortium between institutions. What's going to make them want to do this? Is it going to be, this is going to become the standard, this is the recommendation of the IOM? Gil was talking about confirmatory. You know, in my own lab now, if I'm publishing a high-profile result, I've caught so many errors making somebody else do something that somebody, making every high-profile result be replicated by at least two people in the laboratory, I can run around till I'm blue in the face telling people that they have to do that. But if this is a recommendation and this becomes a sort of standard, I think that makes a really big difference. So articulating maybe the handful of things that
yeah.
you think are going to be critical,
prioritizing
is
yes,
going
to
be
huge. Yes, you're saying first, people might actually listen to the recommendations. Second, there's choices among things that are really expensive and burdensome to do.
Right.
And it sounds like what you're saying is try, if possible, to pick a small number of doable and likely to be useful things, something along those lines. Is that fair?
Right. And I think the data provenance issue, if I were going to pick a handful, I would pick things like the data provenance issue, because having data systems is going to take a while to develop, and people need to start thinking about what that's going to look like. I think the notion of getting different institutions to buy into helping each other review this area of science, both because of conflict of interest and because individual institutions may not have the expertise or the objectivity, I think that's another area. And the other area that we touched upon at the very beginning of the day was how the journals and funding agencies can help institutions identify problem areas. In other words, if they flag, you know, if somebody complains 10 times to Cell that this group that the data appears as, you know, Gil said, if it forms a straight line every time, you start to get a little suspicious. I am quite sure that journal editors hear that about certain investigators. And do they ever flag the institutions?
It's interesting to hear you say the universities might invite it, because it's headings for universities, while it's, you know, really part of their beat and part of their responsibility. Right. We've gotten the sense that some journals, like Kathy DeAngelis, like doing it. There's other journals that would rather just have this go away. And I think your statement that this might be helpful is sort of surprising and very interesting and maybe empowering to hear.
I mean, it's the difference between, you know, a scientific journal and a magazine, right? Like, you know, there are people that these journals have different motivations and what they're trying to do. And I think by saying your responsibility, if you're calling yourselves a scientific journal, yeah, is to alert institutions when things appear to be outside the norms, I think that could be a positive cultural.
Just be aware, as a journal editor, we have a case in the journal I edit, American Heart Journal, where we notified the dean at the institution, and the next notification was a threat of a lawsuit against the journal and the editors for impugning the integrity of the institution and the investigator. So, again, we get
That's
into this.
That's why the IUM has to say it.
Litigious society.
Blame-free reporting, national.
Well, Rob, do you have any advice in a couple of words about how that might, is this sort of frivolous, or is this a substantive worry, or what are your thoughts about that?
It's a substantive worry because even though you may eventually win such a case, you may end up being tied up in depositions and all sorts of things. Now, I should also say that, I don't know about other fields in detail, but in cardiology, we have a group that meets at every one of their three global cardiovascular meetings. The journal editors meet, and we do trade inside information about people who we think may have a problem so that we can be on the lookout, and that's done confidentially without notifying the institutions. So that could be improved, but it's not that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, there are these consortia of major journal editors, and I think a lot of good has come from that already, and maybe could be addressed more. Want to make any further comments, Sally?
No, I'm good, thank you.
I do want to ask, maybe you're the right person to ask this question.
I've perceived a problem in my own experience and others with increasing numbers of young people and any age people doing all their work on a laptop, or whatever work they do, the data on a laptop. And the day comes when they walk out the door to a job or next step, and the laptop goes with them. What is the process for having the laboratory have its permanent data documentation in laboratory basic research?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't given it a lot of thought. In our own, I mean, I can speak from personal experience, the laboratory, while that data is mandated to live on the departmental server as well. In other words, we don't have anything in my lab, for instance, that, at least I don't think we do, that would be uniquely on laptops. And all of the primary data is expected to be left behind, so aside from just documentation, so that other future members of the laboratory that want to go back and look at the original data can do so. But, you know, now that you bring that up, I guess as an institution, we have not addressed that as policy. We've addressed maintaining lab notebooks as property of the laboratory going forward, you know, X number of years. But I think that's something we need to think about. In other words, making sure that data that are digitized in any form or databases need to live on servers that are maintained at the institution, at least as a duplicate.
Anybody else concerned about this problem?
I certainly am. You know, I think that's one of the things I've tried to confront in the research groups have been with. And I do think the comment that Dr. Demetz made earlier, that these data types, you know, unfortunately break the model of a lab notebook, you know, whether or not you were keeping track of things. So, you know, what I push for or what I see as a solution to that are centralized resources that a university can draw from. and that there are, there are buzzwords like cloud computing, but, you know, it's really not that complicated. It's about having, you know, web-based resources, and I think centralizing things at a lab level, at a center level, at an institute level, to both give people resources that they can use. I think the biggest question, so everyone recognizes that Frank Harrell has come to Duke and given a talk numerous times to try and get people to stop working with Microsoft Excel. Everyone recognizes Excel as a problem, but I think there's a real honest answer from any young investigator to say, okay, well, then tell me how I should otherwise be handling my data. And from a basic science lab, I think the clinical realm has many decades of experience with this problem. But I think the ability to develop centralized web-based resources at an institution level that can be broadly used is something that needs to be incentivized as much as possible, and something I'm individually trying to do as a bioinformatics professor in the School of Medicine is to work towards building processes that can be done by people who, for better or for worse, may not be PhD-trained biostatisticians, but who are going to be handling and working with these data until we clone biostatisticians 10 times over.
Well, not only that, I mean, we're all talking about, you know, terabytes per week or even terabytes per day from next-gen sequencing.
Right.
But it's truly, I mean, beside the fact that it's very unlikely that people would do anything but regenerate the data when they need it eventually. Anyway, so much of these data sets is insufficiently annotated, so you can't tell what they are, where they came from,
and individually
any links to useful correlative data anyway.
And every researcher is keeping their own data sets, their own files, and are not drawing on central servers. So I think there is a strong educational component here that needs to be done at an institutional and national level to really teach better practices.
Yep. Sally, yeah.
No, I was going to say, going back to the basic science lab, we're looking at electronic notebook options. You know, there are various vendors out there. The question then becomes whether you mandate them or you make them available, and you know what sort of transition time. So we're certainly having those discussions.
And Michael?
At the end of the line, at the end of the
discussion,
no, but we'll come back to Rob. I'll say that I wouldn't underestimate the cultural shift towards the team-based research in this particular area. You know, much of what we talked about today is good clinical practice with the capital GCP, or good trial practice, and what we hope for at all of our universities and research institutes. But it's only really the last 5 or 10 years that medicine itself has gone from an individual sport to a team sport. And we're still sort of in that cultural transition. As I meet with our graduate residents and our medical students, they still don't really fully understand that. And those that are at the end of their career, this is a difficult transition. This type of research is a little trickier. When there's a device that's moving rapidly to the clinical world, I can see the device, I can understand it, I'm able to get my hands around it. And Dr. Demetz, as you said, you can't plot this data. It's hard to get your hands around it. And therefore, as it jumps, the necessity of having robust systems and the team become that much more important. You know, we've always prided ourselves as being clinical leaders. We've had clinical trials leadership for decades. We've had notable leadership in conflict of interest in other areas. And despite typical and sometimes very good systems, in this case, the collection of those symptoms of those systems didn't succeed for us. And so as we move forward, you know, we're committed to implementing the TMQF. We've been on this cultural SBR journey for 5 or more years and feel as though we're really arriving now. And then we're going to look forward to these results. But I think for the field, if what you recommend is strong enough, this will be a difficult transition.
Bob?
They're definitely at the end of the day. As Christine and Cheryl know, I've had the privilege of being part of a lot of IRM committees that have made recommendations. And been one of the most fun parts of my career because you have an enormous bully pulpit. You have a chance to influence thinking not just immediately, but in the future, as people refer to it. So, you know, there are three elements that I hope that you will completely clarify for the future world. The first is what you've been talking about, which is, you know, there are things written. There's specific paths, and there are diagrams and charts of how it should be done that are somewhat mechanical. But I think aggregating that information and clarifying it and improving it, that's point number one, and I know you're doing that. I think more important, though, is point number two, which I think this is a frame shift in biomedical science. I think as I go around, and certainly when we sent this questionnaire out to people at different institutions, and the range of emotions from horror to how can you do this to us to this is great, can you add these questions? I think the multidimensional nature of data, the enormous growth of teams, which, you know, in this case we're talking about within an institution, but we're now talking about global teams working on data with no impediments. You know, I'm stuck in the TMQI framework that we developed, but surely you'll see a better way of doing it. You've got a broader input than we do. So I hope you can see some of the things we write, particularly in the implementation where we're raising these issues, and we'll certainly share this with you as we go along. So letting the world know about a frame shift that's occurring that's not limited to genomics, but is broader. And the last one, I think a lot of the, you know, you mentioned this 10 years later, we're stuck with the same predictive model being marketed because people are afraid to change it. Because after all, the minute you change something, you need a validation study in a human population that can take years, you know, maybe another decade just to collect the relevant data. I think the big change that's about to hit us all is the democratization of information. There's 6 billion people in the world. You can collect data from India just as quickly as you can collect it from the United States, probably better because cell phones work better there. And I think some thinking by this committee about even if we did one and two, specific path and frame shift, we're not going to solve the bigger problem, which is people would like the best prediction, and they'd like it to be continuously updated in a way that's, whether you call it marketed or used in clinical practice, that's used in clinical practice without all the false positives and the bad predictions. And that's only going to happen with a fairly radically different view of how we aggregate information on a global basis. As you said, get it off of individual laptops and into places where the world of scientists can look at it and make it better. And I think that's what you've heard several people refer to here that we're beginning to realize. I was in a meeting last month with the Kauffman Foundation on innovation, and someone who was objecting to the crazy ideas that we had said, well, you know, what's this about democratization of information? You know, when Einstein had his theories, it was estimated that only 5 people in the U.S. could have understood, you know, what he was saying. And then somebody else said, what if the Internet was available and you had all the people in India and China and Brazil and Eastern Europe? It probably would have been a couple of 1,000 people could have contributed to that and moved things along faster. So it sounds a little crazy, but I think capability of getting information from all over the world is so vast now, and it's the only solution I can think of to the problem that if you want to take a decade to move from 70 lousy predictors to 72 that are a bit better, if you want to shorten that, you're going to have to let the world know we need to open up. Now, you guys can think of how to do it better than I can, but I know it's an issue.
Rob, just about question 3 and whether it's in the ballpark of the committee. This may be a topic for another time. But are you saying the rate-limiting step is the volume of data in understanding predictors, or is it sort of the design and quality of, you've had so much experience with that in cardiology, isn't quality awful, awful, awful important?
Quality is critical, but I think the rate-limiting step is understanding how to put the data into a quality framework, to use some terms we've been using. So there is no limit. So let's just take a type of cancer. that, you know, we labor right now in a single institution to develop enough information to do something useful. You know, we're now talking about consortia that involve all of Asia, South America, Eastern Europe. You can accumulate a lot of cases in a hurry and get answers much more quickly as to whether the predictive instruments work, and as you evolve them to make them better, you could do it more quickly. But our data frameworks, our analysis frameworks, our regulatory systems are designed almost in a way that impedes the ability to do that. I mean, just the time it would take to submit something to the FDA and get an answer back right now.
At least you can do things online now.
Yeah, well,
that you couldn't do.
You can
wait it on the mail.
So technically, you can do it. I think it's all cultural at this point.
Actually, just a brief mention, there's a little company called InnoCentive. Maybe you've heard of it. InnoCentive Innovation. I happen to be on their advisory board. And what they do is they link through the internet folks that have problems for which they like solutions that they haven't found themselves. These are companies and now not-for-profits and federal agencies and potential solvers. And the solvers community is over 200,000 self-identified folks, all kinds of demography, and estimated millions through Economist, Nature, and some other organizations that have made partnerships with them. So it's pretty interesting.